Welcome to another edition of Geopolitics and Empire. Quick reminder, support the broadcast, become a paid subscriber on the Substack, $5 a month or $50 a year. You can also buy me a coffee or send reinforcements through my donor box. We are joined today by Katie Gorka, who served as director for civil society at the Heritage Foundation. Prior to that, she worked as a presidential appointee in the Office of Policy at the Department of Homeland Security, among numerous other previous positions. And she is the co-author of the new book just out titled Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It, from Encounter Books. I'm a fan of Encounter Books. Welcome to the podcast, Katie.
Hey, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We've been treating this subject on the podcast for a while now. I think it's an important subject. I had Jeffrey Paul on, J. Michael Waller, and now yourself. And so, Next Gen Marxism, what spurred you to write the book, to identify this sort of as our main threat? Do you feel it's the principal threat to the USA today?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I really do. So what spurred it is, as you mentioned in my bio, I left the Trump administration and then I went over to the Heritage Foundation. And there were a couple things going on. So that was like right before the COVID shutdown that I made that move. And, you know, one of the first things I got really involved with at Heritage was pushing back on that New York Times project, that the 1619 project, which came out in August 2019. And if you remember, that was Hannah Nicole Jones leading that effort. And it was really rewriting our history. And telling us that we were systemically racist and we've always been racist. We are founded on racism. She actually argued that the American Revolution was fought in order to protect slavery, and just other kind of falsehoods. So I started out working on that. Of course, things quickly shifted. You know, so many things happened in 2020. The two most important being, of course, the COVID shutdown, which, you know, that was the beginning of the big parent revolution, because that's when everybody started seeing what their kids were being taught, right? And they were up in arms. And so I was really fortunate because I was able to start traveling around the country, working with these nascent parent groups very early on and seeing what they were up against and how they were fighting back. But then, of course, the other thing you had were the George Floyd riots and protests, which were, many of which were violent. So Mike Gonzalez was a colleague of mine at Heritage. I admire him a lot. And we have a lot of sort of shared interests because I'm an American, but I lived in Hungary for 12 years because of Sebastian, my husband. So that, you know, I really had that firsthand experience of post-communism. Mike's family had to flee Cuba when he was a child. So he had a very personal, you know, relationship to communism as well. So we were both, you know, we're both really passionate about defending American freedom. And we were looking at the world around us and saying, it's gone crazy. We need to study this. You know, we need to understand how we got here. And we need to put more tools into the hands of Americans to fight back. So that was the genesis of the book. That's what got us started.
Yeah, you know, I mention often I'm ethnically a Croat, proud Croatian citizen as well. My name literally means Croat. And my grandfather was a prisoner for half a year of, I believe, the Croatian fascist regime during World War II. And then my parents came from communist Yugoslavia. And so I kind of have a little bit of a taste of that as well. And being born in the U.S., it's like you're born with these ideas of freedom and liberty. And you start your book looking at the history, you know, sort of the deep history, and then bringing us through the 20th century of how Marxism has transformed. And, you know, I still can't believe how people today are taken by these ideas of this communist collectivism and Marxism. And so if you want to maybe just tell us a bit about, you know, and it's good to remind ourselves of the history of as well. If you want to tell us a bit about how you see the original utopian, more like dystopian idea of Marxism, and then, you know, how it's transformed into this sort of new version of Marxism.
Yeah. So, I mean, I sort of look at, there's a couple different periods. I mean, Marxism in the beginning was a real failure. You know, Marx's ideas really never took off for the first 70 years, in spite of all of his efforts, in spite of, you know, going to international conferences and trying to organize people. They never took hold. The only thing that allowed them to take hold ultimately was the sort of evil genius of Vladimir Lenin, right? Lenin came up with this formula where he, and this is kind of the magic formula, actually, where he recognized the workers, in fact, will not spontaneously rise up because they actually like their jobs, you know, they want to keep working, right? So Lenin came up with this magic formula, which was use propaganda and information wisely to create a sense of grievance and victimhood, and then organize for revolution. That's kind of the formula. And it worked incredibly well in, you know, Russia. Agrarian Russia became Soviet Russia. That's what allowed communism to take hold in the Soviet Union. But then there was kind of another turning point because it didn't work anywhere else. So when the Bolshevik Revolution succeeded in Russia, it was actually very inspiring to the socialists and revolutionaries throughout the world, right? In the United States. I mean, granted, they weren't big in number, but they were out there. You had them in the United States, you had them in Italy, you had them in Germany. But yet, and they all thought, now is the moment. We're going to have our revolution. But it still didn't happen. And so particularly when the communist revolutions failed in 1919, 1920 in Italy and Germany, two very important things happened. You had Antonio Gramsci, one of the leaders of the Italian Revolution, go off to prison, where he had 9 glorious years to reflect on why did the revolution fail? And what can we do differently to make it succeed? And he came up with sort of the next iteration, and we generally call this cultural Marxism. What he finally concluded and what he argued is you don't bring about the revolution through violence. You bring about the revolution through changing the culture, changing the way people think. So you need to get into the cultural institutions. The other important thing that happened was the failed German Revolution. And there you had a handful of people who were instrumental in that, who had to flee, people like Marcuse and others, Herbert Marcuse. Where did they go? Lo and behold, Columbia University, you know, and we're so surprised to see what we're seeing today. Anyway, they came to the United States. They found a home at Columbia University. They brought their ideas with them. Marcuse was very influential in the student movement of the 60s. But, you know, the combination of sort of Marcuse and the others from the Frankfurt School with Gramsci, the result was, I would say, what we call the new left. It was this transition again at the end, very end of the 50s, where they said, okay, the revolutionaries, it's not going to be the workers. It's going to be students working in partnership with the disenfranchised, like particularly Africans Americans living in the ghettos. That was going to be the new revolution. You know, and it's so, again, I just, you know, it's so interesting to look at what's happening on the campuses today. Here's something that I read about doing the research that I never knew this. 1959, McGeorge Bundy, who later became the head of the Ford Foundation, he, as the dean of students at Harvard University, welcomed Fidel Castro to come and speak to the students of Harvard, having just overthrown the regime in Cuba. And it's like, again, I have to ask you, you know, we wonder why we are where we are today. You know, these things have been sort of simmering in our universities for decades. But anyway, so let me bring us up to the last phase. Okay, so that's cultural Marxism. The last phase was really initiated by the failure of the student revolutions of the 1960s, right? They got to the end of the 1960s. They said, well, we didn't achieve what we wanted. We didn't end the war in Vietnam. we didn't bring about the civil rights reforms that we wanted. So they kind of went one of three directions. They either went crazy radical and full bore terrorist in the form of the Weather Underground, or they said, and this was very Leninist kind of Saul Alinsky, they said, we need to organize better. We need to be training people and organizing for revolution. The couple of sort of groups worth mentioning here, one is the Midwest Academy, which was formed in 1969 by some of these student radicals with help from Saul Alinsky. Barack Obama came out of that. Another one that's been very important was actually not formed until 1989. That was formed by Eric Mann, one of the Weather Underground terrorists, formed something in LA called the Los Angeles, I'm going to blank on the name because it's Center for Training and Labor. I can't remember the exact name. So he formed a group in Los Angeles. And who was one of his early recruits? A 17-year-old Patrice Couleurs, who became the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. So you see that thread of how these 60s revolutionaries kind of fueled all the things that are happening today. I'll mention just one more thread in this world. And that is, I said to you, student revolutionaries kind of went one of three directions, right? Weather Underground and terrorism, organizing, or the third group said, we're going into the universities. And they became professors. In the book, we kind of really drill down on the critical legal theorists because that was the direct precursor to critical race theory, which emerged in 1989. But that's how you get to where we are today, where it is no longer now the students, even though actually our students today are being very revolutionary. But the real idea today is the revolutionaries are going to be those who are identified by characteristics such as their race, their ethnicity, or their sexual identity. They are organized. There's a whole movement to make people feel aggrieved. And they are hoping for, they're working toward revolution. They are very clear about this. They want to bring down the United States as we know it. They want to radically change it.
Yeah. And, you know, I went to university in the U.S. as well as in Switzerland. I taught here in Mexico at the top private university. And it's not just the U.S. I mean, this now has this mind virus has gone global beyond the U.S. You know, in Mexico, I taught a course, Environments and International Relations. You talk about climate as well. That's one of their tools. In your book, you discuss it. And I had a class of a mix of Mexican and international students, and I can tell you 90%+ were, you know, left-wing Marxists. They believed the official narrative. So that stuff, you know, that's here in Mexico, as you mentioned, in the schools in the U.S. And then now it's beyond just academia, because those professors and now students, those students graduate, they go work in the workforce, and then the corporate space also becomes wokeified. And just a bit more on the method to this madness. You mentioned they're using race now, sex, gender, transgender stuff, gender ideology, the climate agenda. And you talk about the strategy for them transforming the cultures, you know, speech codes now, cancel culture, victimhood. You said the elevation of victimhood to a national cult. And so if you could tell us a bit more about, you know, how and why they're using these methods.
Well, I'd love to also just go for a minute into this idea, because I think it's really fascinating that you've taught in Mexico and you've seen it there. Because one of the really important things that we talk about in the book is the international component to this. You know, I think if you asked the ordinary American today, I think if you were to ask virtually any American today about the George Floyd protests, they would tell you that it was a spontaneous uprising, right? In protest against the killing of George Floyd. What Mike and I found is it was absolutely not the case. I mean, you have had European Marxists working with Latin American Marxists for years, and then you had Americans starting to go down there and work with them. But then they kind of eventually turned around and said, hey, you guys stop coming here. You need to help get your government's boot off of our neck. We need you to better organize in your own country. And so that started happening. And that was, you know, Black Lives Matter came out of that. And it, what's also very interesting in light of what's happening today is that the Palestinians were part of those early organizing meetings. So this stuff has been all wrapped up together for a long time. And I'll tell you what else, who else is at the table is some of our top enemies. China has been present at these meetings, Venezuela, Russia, Iran, they've all got a hand in this, you know? And that's why I just think it is so important. I mean, look, most of us don't want to spend our evenings reading about Marxism, but, you know, for anybody who loves this country, for anybody who loves freedom, I truly believe you have to understand exactly what it is we are up against. Otherwise, you might just say, well, it'll burn itself out, or no, it's not so serious. No, it is really serious. I mean, and I just hope that, you know, every time we have a wave like what's happening right now on our college campuses, I hope it's a wake-up call to people to say this is far more serious than we thought it was. You know, and I'm, you know, another just million-dollar question is, like, for how much longer are parents going to shell out $70,000 a year to send their kids to these indoctrinating institutions? You know, it's, we have to stop doing this. And as alumni, we have to stop funding them.
Yeah, and just on the note of the BLM and Palestine, I saw someone on social media recently discuss how, and I think it was a good point, the whole pro-Palestine protest now in the U.S., it's like BLM 2.0, and then you write in your book, you say, if one word could adequately sum up all that the Leninists have learned about the technology of mass manipulation in the 20th century, that word would be organization. You also write that you mentioned Garza donning a Palestinian kafieh, putting it in a 2010 social forum meeting in Oakland, saying the social forum is not a conference, it's a movement building process, and saying it was these networks that prepared Garza and the other BLM founders for when the moment would come, so on and so forth. And it's I haven't talked much in Israel-Palestine thing, but I myself feel like I don't have skin in the game, but I can't call myself pro-Palestinian, you know, because a lot of that movement is, you know, I disagree with what Israel is doing, smashing homes and expanding willy-nilly, but still, it's like, it feels like a lot of the pro-Palestine movement is left-wing communist. No, any just further thought on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. You know, there was a great clip that I think Elon Musk retweeted. Now it's probably 4 to 6 weeks ago, but it was one of the pro-Palestinian protesters caught on tape telling somebody else, well, you know, this isn't really about Palestine. This is really about taking down the United States. And yes, absolutely. And I think you also have to really, you have to really ask yourself, what's driving this? What's behind this? I mean, I know that there is absolutely some legitimate outrage, you know, whatever, people are upset, but it is absolutely being used and manipulated. And I just, you know, just one small example, if you look at the image of the protesters, their encampment at Columbia University, there's about 40 tents. They are all the exact same tent. Like, what? We all shop at the same store? You know, it's like, you know, clearly this stuff is being orchestrated. You know, I live just about a mile from Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State. They've had an encampment going for months now. I think it's actually started right after the attack. I think people are being paid. I think it's being orchestrated. I don't think it's spontaneous. And I think even the stuff on campuses is being orchestrated.
Yeah, and again, it's not to downplay the atrocities that have happened. The Palestinians had that happen, killed, including Palestinian Christians. But my point is, you know, I like James Lindsay, and he often says the issue is never the issue. It's about the revolution. So whether
actually, and that's not him speaking, he's quoting.
Right.
That's absolutely a very famous quote. Exactly. Right. And that's exactly what next gen Marxism is all about. You can take any issue. You can take race, sex, gender, sexual orientation, climate, environment, Palestine, any of these issues you can use for the good of the revolution.
Yeah, and that's why we have to be careful. So, you know, we have to kind of look at things objectively. It's like, okay, yeah, there's grievances definitely legitimate for Palestinians, but now it's being used to, again, try to take down the United States. And you write about, again, Gramsci in your book, you say, Gramsci believed that revolutionaries should take part in parliamentary democracy, but only to create the conditions to transfer political power to the councils, which would then work to abolish parliamentary democracy. The mission of the socialist state, next-gen Marxism, was to be a transitional state that would deliver communism. This mission cannot be accomplished by parliamentary democracy. So the goal was the replacement of the democratic parliamentary state by a new type of state. And it feels like, and I ask my guests often, I ask Jeffrey Paul, who says, we're one step away, you know, these elections could decide it, from falling into, you know, he calls it fascism, communism, whatever form of collectivism. It feels like we're at this moment in the U.S. we're on the cusp of a one-party dictatorial system in America. Your thoughts?
It's concerning. I mean, I think what concerns me the most probably right now is the weaponization of law enforcement for political purposes. I think it's just deeply and profoundly concerning. Like, I feel like we've kind of lost the rule of law, you know, that, and that is the foundation, right? When law can be weaponized, you're in serious trouble. But, you know, I can't throw my hands up in despair and say, yes, you know, we're about to go to one party rule. Because I guess partly because I'm very involved on the ground. So, you know, one of the things I did when I left Heritage, I said I left so that I could write the book, but I also left because I realized we can't fix these things from Washington, right? We've got to fix this in our communities. This has got to be from the ground up. And so I said I was going to get much more involved, which I had never done. I was going to get more involved in my local community. And so actually just a couple of weeks ago, I just got elected as the chair of the Fairfax GOP. But it's one of the things that makes me hopeful, because, you know, I'm out there all the time connecting with other Republicans, and there are just so many people that see what's going on. They may not be able to name it. They may not be able to explain to you what makes it Marxist, but they get that it's fundamentally un-American, that it's destroying our freedoms, that it's unjust, that it's wrong. And I see more and more people willing to put themselves on the line to fight back. I'm seeing like the change, I think, that's taken place since this all kind of really started in the winter and spring of 2020, when parents really first started speaking up, or there was, like, let's say, a groundswell of people speaking up. I think people are much less afraid today. I think many more people recognize that they have to stand up and speak up, and it's worth it, even if they take some darts and arrows, right? So that's what I think ultimately makes me feel hopeful. I don't think Americans are going to take this lying down. You know, I think they're going to find a way to really fight this and ultimately prevail.
I sure hope they don't back down. You mentioned weaponization. There was this move to try and impeach Mayorkas of the DHS, which failed. I'm a big fan of Clay Higgins, who was trying to push that, and you formerly worked there. Maybe you can tell someone at the DHS something, because 2 years ago I was singled out by the DHS. They told PayPal to ban me. You know, thanks to the work of people like Mike Benz, he showed through his foundation the documents how DHS and CISA basically got people like myself the platform from PayPal. That was when they rolled out the disinformation governance board. So yeah, they're weaponizing everything against Trump. and other people. You give 10 tactics in your book on how to sort of stop America from descending into tyranny. You already mentioned one of them. You know, any other key principle or thought on what people can do?
Yeah. So I just want to preface it by saying there is no magic bullet, right? I think a lot of people want to hear like, oh, if you just do this, you know, you'll fix it. No, it takes really hard work. And, you know, one of the things that we did was we looked back at history, at things that have worked in the past. So there's a group that I particularly like, something called the Active Measures Working Group, that we kind of took lessons from that. That was a group in and out of government that helped really fight back against the disinformation of the Soviet Union. And some of the lessons from those things are, first of all, you have to speak truth. You know, you just can't back down. You know who's so good on that is Solzhenitsyn, you know, the Russian dissident writer. Like, he just, you know, if you need encouragement, just go spend a day reading Solzhenitsyn, and he will inspire you. You have got to speak up and tell the truth. I think it's also really important that you not do it alone. I think that's one of the biggest lessons as well, is that it can be scary. You know, my husband and I took a lot of flack when we were in the Trump administration, but we always had each other and we kind of got through it and realized actually they can't hurt you that much, you know? And so I think finding others who are like-minded and joining together is really important. I think it's also super important to, and I've said this already, but I'll reiterate it. I think it's really important to understand what we're facing. Read our book. I think it's really important for Americans to re-educate themselves about the founding. You know, anybody, even my age, like I was born in 60, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. Even by that time, I would say civics education was kind of on the decline already. And most of my education about the American founding, I have gotten as an adult. And anyway, it's completely different when you're a high school student having to cram this stuff for the AP exam versus reading it as an adult because you're living it, right? I think it's really important for people to understand the founding principles and why the founders set up our country the way they did in order for you to be able to defend it. So, I would say those are some of the highlights. And then on the flip side, we did talk a lot about there is a very important role for state and local government, right? We talk about some of the things that some of the extraordinary governors have done to get DEI out of the universities to fight back on some of the content in schools. But again, I would just reiterate there, that's why elections are so important, right? Everybody needs to be involved. And everybody who cares about the country, who cares about freedom, needs to be involved with their local Republican Party and become an election officer, become a poll watcher, become a volunteer. Most of our, higher level politicians start out down low. You know, they start out at the school board or, you know, a House delegate, whatever. So those local elections, you know, which a lot of people don't pay attention to, they're super, super important. So I just really encourage people to get involved and play a role.
I always ask myself this question, and I feel important to ask my guests this question. I stare into the abyss often to do that thought experiment. It's a way to motivate me to try and not get there. And the question would be, you know, what if America fell? What would the world look like? I've heard so many people, guests of mine on my podcast from different parts of the world, say, you know, if America falls, it's over because there's no other geography that has that economic power, that military power, that culture of liberty, that would be able to stave off this march on of global totalitarianism. So have you asked yourself that question? You know, what do you think it would look like?
Well, I approach it in a slightly different way, which is there's a human rights activist from China who I really admire, a man named Chen Guangcheng. He's known as the blind lawyer. He's a man who was blind, but taught himself the law and ended up defending women who were being forced into the one-child policy. And he helped defend their right to keep their children and to not have forced abortions. And he reached a point, he was under house arrest, and he was able to escape from the house and walk, I want to say, like a couple hundred miles blind into a city. And he had to decide where to go. Where was he going to go for help? And he said there was no question in his mind that he would, the only place to go was the American embassy. If the United States falls, there is nowhere else to go.
That's, yeah, sadly, that's the case. And, you know, any final thought for us? And if you want to tell us your projects, best places to find you or get the book?
Yeah, so I always love it if people can buy the book at a local bookstore. But if you don't have one, or if your local bookstore is a revolutionary bookstore, as many of them are, get it off of Amazon. And then I will just mention as well that I too have a podcast. It's called the Happy Women Podcast. And I do this with my good friend, Jennifer Horn. And we really highlight, particularly, you know, the stories of people who are changing their communities. And so it's a lot about, you know, how to be a happy warrior. So people can find me there. And then I also have a website, katiegorka.org.
Yeah, happy warrior. That's a theme I try to get across as well on this podcast. Regardless of how bad things look, we have to be happy, cheerful every day. You know, I always say, we can laugh on the way to the gulag. If it gets, and look to look to people like Solzhenitsyn, Richard Wurmbrands of the world, the Dietrich Bonhoeffers for inspiration. And the book, again, Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Thanks for being on Geopolitics and Empire.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.